Piano? Play something for me. He got up from the stool, and I sat down at the piano, absolutely petrified. Knowing what I chose to play could mean the difference between life and death. So I took a deep breath and thought, if I'm about to die, this is what I want to play. Debussy's Clair de Lune. I played my heart out, and when I finished, I looked up from the piano and saw that there were tears in his eyes. It turns out that before the war, he had been in the diplomatic corps in Paris. Debussy was his favorite. He let me go, and twice a week for the next year, he made me come over to his house and play the piano for him. Arling shook her head incredulously at the story.
You were very lucky to get away like that. How did you and your friends get into the botanic gardens in the first place?
Sui gave her a sphinx-like smile, as if she was trying to decide whether or not to let her in on something. And then she shared her secret. Emerging from the memory of Sui's story, an idea began to form in Arling's mind. She looked up at Vikram and said,
There is a secret about this house that even you don't know. Something from the war times.
Vikram looked at her in surprise. Arling continued,
Now, don't you have connections in the Ku household?
Sure, I know the head of security very well.
This is what I need you to do.
Nick and Colin were spending the afternoon hanging out at Red Point Record Warehouse on Playfair Road, where they had spent countless hours listening to obscure records back when they were teenagers. As Nick flipped through the meticulously organized bins, he called out to Colin,
Did you know that the Cocteau Twins collaborated with Fei Wong?
No way!
Take a look at this,
Nick said, handing him a record. While Colin read the liner notes to a rare EP recorded by the Hong Kong diva titled The Amusement Park, his phone buzzed with a text message. He glanced at the screen and read a message from Aloysius Pang, the head of his family's security team, summoning him to his father's house to pick up a package ASAP. Colin wondered what this was all about, as it was highly uncharacteristic of Aloysius to summon him like this.
Hey, Nick! I need to run over to my dad's place to pick up something that's apparently quite urgent. Do you want to stay here or come with?
I'll come along. If I stay any longer, I'll just end up buying the whole store, Nick replied.
The two of them sped over to Colin's father's house on Leedon Road, a stately Georgian mansion that looked like it had been transported straight out of Bel Air, California.
Geez, it's been years since I've been here, Nick remarked as they entered the house through the front door.
A grandfather clock ticked loudly in the circular foyer, and all the curtains in the formal living room had been closed to block out the afternoon sun.
Is anyone home?
My dad and stepmom are on a safari in Kenya at the moment, Colin answered, as a Filipino maid appeared from the corridor. Is Aloysius here?
No, but there's a package for you, Sir Colin,
the woman replied. She went into the kitchen and returned moments later with a large padded envelope that didn't bear the markings of any courier service.
Who dropped this off? Colin asked.
Sir, Mr. Pang, sir.
He ripped open the envelope, and inside was a smaller manila envelope that was stamped private and confidential. There was a post-it affixed to the front of it. Colin looked up at Nick in surprise.
This package isn't for me.
It's for you.
Really?
Taking the package, Nick saw that the post-it note read, Please give this letter by hand to your friend Nicholas Young. It is imperative that he receives it by tonight.
Well, this is convenient. I guess whoever sent this knows I'm crashing at your place, Nick said as he began tearing into the sealed envelope.
Wait, wait. Are you sure you want to do that? Colin said.
Why not?
Colin glanced suspiciously at the package.
I don't know.
What if there's anthrax or something in there?
I don't think my life is as exciting as that, but here, why don't you open it?
Fuck no. Nick laughed as he continued to open the envelope. Has anyone told you that you have an overactive imagination?
Dude, I'm not the one getting mysterious packages delivered to my best friend's house, Colin said, taking a few steps back.
Chapter 11. 28 Cluny Park Road, Singapore. Nigel Barker had photographed some of the most famous and beautiful women in the world, from Iman to Taylor Swift. But he'd never had a subject fly him halfway around the world in their personal Boeing 747-81 VIP before. And he had never gotten a lymphatic drainage massage and a seaweed exfoliating body wrap in a private spa on a private jet. Naturally, when he arrived at Kitty Bing's gracious heritage bungalow on 28 Cluny Park Road with his team of four photo assistants, there was yet another never-before-witnessed drama unfolding. A Chinese man, wearing a deconstructed black Moroccan jalaba, was standing on the front driveway, screaming,
"Chuan! Where the fuck did you put the Oscar de la Renta? If you didn't pack it, I'm going to fucking skin you alive! Chuan!"
As he yelled, he bounced several inches off the ground, looking like a deranged Jedi. 20 feet from the main house, a huge tent had been set up, and Nigel could see dozens of fashion assistants in white lab coats rushing from the house to the tent with various bits of clothing, while another set of assistants within the tent were going through the rolling racks filled with hundreds of ball gowns straight from the Paris catwalks. A guy in a white denim, zip-up jumpsuit came running out of the tent.
"We're still steaming it. It just arrived from New York 30 minutes ago."
"Kanina, I need the dress now, you good-for-nothing gundu."
Don't quote me on this, but I believe a gundu is the Malay cousin of a gundu sami, India, which is in turn distantly related to a gumba, Jersey Shore and certain suburbs of Long Island. Nigel approached the ranting Jedi warily.
"I'm assuming this is the location for the tattle photo shoot?"
"Wow!" the man gasped, putting his hands to his mouth.
He suddenly stood ramrod straight. His face went from manic to zen in a nanosecond, and his speech took on a pseudo-English meets Euro-trash accent.
"Nigel Barker, it's really you.
Nerd!
You are even more dashing in person. How is that possible? I'm Patrick, the couture consultant. I'm styling the shoot today."
"Pleasure to meet you," Nigel replied in a real English accent. Patrick kept staring Nigel up and down.
"It's an honor to be working with you. I've worked with Matt and Marcus, Ines and Venud, Bruce and Nan, Alexis and Tico. I've worked with them all. Now come with me.
We're having a mini-crisis at the moment,
but I think your presence will help calm things down."
They entered the house, which was filled with more staffers rushing around frantically at full speed.
"As you know, Mrs. Bing has spared no expense on this shoot. Oliver Sen flew in the top hairstylist from New York, the top makeup artist from London, and the top set designers from Italy for this shoot.
Everyone's a top.
And we're having to compete for space with all these tops. It's not how I usually like to work," Patrick said, with an arched eyebrow.
Climbing up the beautiful arts and crafts style wooden staircase, he led Nigel to the door of the library.
"Brace yourself," Patrick warned as he cracked open the door slowly.
Inside, Nigel could see a woman seated in a hairdresser's chair in front of a bank of lighted mirrors, her face streaked in tears, surrounded by half a dozen stylists.
"Kitty! Kitty!
I have a little treat for you,"
Patrick cooed. Kitty looked in the mirror and saw them approaching.
"Nigel! Nigel Barker!"
"Oh no, this isn't how I wanted you to meet me for the first time.
Look at my hair. Look at what they've done. It looks terrible, doesn't it?"
Nigel glanced at the floor quickly and saw that they had lopped off about 90% of her hair. Kitty now had a pixie hairstyle that actually looked incredibly chic.
Kitty, it's a pleasure to meet you, and I think you look wonderful. See, we wanted a radical change, and this is a terrific look for you. It's very gamine.
Oliver tried to reassure her in a calm voice.
You look like Emma Watson. Wait till we do the color, Joe the hairstylist said.
No. No. I'm not desirable anymore. I look like a mother. Nigel, what do you think? Would you ever want to make love to me looking like this?
Kitty swiveled her chair around dramatically and gave him a piercing stare. Nigel hesitated for a moment.
Now don't make things awkward for Nigel. He's a married man,
said a blonde woman with a British accent. Hello, Charlotte. I didn't know you'd be here, Nigel said, giving the makeup artist a quick hug. Patrick continued to reassure her.
Kitty,
by the time Joe Blackwell Preston is done with your hair color, Charlotte Tilbury is done with your makeup, I'm done pouring you into an amazing gown, and Nigel works his magic, you will look like the very definition of MILF.
All the husbands and teenage boys who see you in these photos will want to take the magazine into the bathroom with them, trust me.
Kitty, remember what we discussed, Oliver said. The entire point of this photo shoot is to reposition your image. You're not supposed to look like a high-fashion temptress anymore. You're going to look like a supremely elegant hostess who's not trying too hard to impress. A cultural force and a rising civic leader.
Charlotte, think of those photos by Skrebneski of Jacqueline Derib in her Paris apartment. Or CZ Guest bending down to pet her poodle. Or Marina Rust on her wedding day. We want young, regal, comme il faut.
Ollie, we're going to comme il faut the hell out of her.
Kitty, dry your tears.
We need to give your face one of my emergency hyaluronic acid boosters right now before it gets too puffy, Charlotte commanded.
And then we're going to add the subtlest sun-kissed highlights to your hair.
You'll look like you just came back from a summer in the Seychelles, Joe proclaimed.
2 hours later, Kitty was posed on a Regency settee in front of the Palace of 18 Perfections, the magnificent Chinese scroll painting she had purchased 2 years ago for a record-breaking $195 million. She was dressed in a pale pink Oscar de la Renta off-the-shoulder ball gown, the billowing Duchess satin skirt pooling gloriously around her, and on her head was a delicate Edwardian pearl headband. Giselle, in an adorable Mishka Aoki cornflower blue dress with feathers and cascading ruffles, was positioned lying on the settee, one leg dangling and her head resting on her mother's lap. Harvard stood on the other side of his mother, with his arms around her neck, looking precious in a white sailor suit with navy blue piping from Bond Point and white socks that went up to his knees. At the foot of the settee lay a gleaming pair of Irish setters. Nigel had imagined Kitty's cover shot as a sort of a modern-day recreation of a Watteau portrait. And to achieve this, he had brought all the way from New York the enormous Polaroid 20x24 camera. There were only 6 of these unique handmade cameras in the entire world, and so precious were the prints that every frame Nigel shot would cost $500. But the camera was somehow able to achieve an indescribable alchemy, creating images that were remarkably crisp and yet otherworldly. To go along with this concept, Nigel had confected an extraordinary blend of natural light fused with massive studio lights to create the sort of dappled, late-afternoon northern light straight out of an 18th-century atelier.
Giselle, you have the prettiest smile, Nigel remarked as he stared into his viewfinder.
Harvard was distracted by the dogs and kept reaching down to try to pet them.
Harvard, give your mummy a kiss, Nigel encouraged.
And then at the precise moment, just as Giselle was relaxing into her smile, Harvard was planting kisses on his mother's cheek, and the sunlight was hitting the painting at just the right angle, Nigel asked, "Kitty, what are you thinking?" Her expression suddenly took on a faraway look, and Nigel clicked the shutter, knowing he had just captured the defining shot. Minutes later, the giant Polaroid was ready, and Toby, the first assistant, carefully placed the print on a special easel at the back of the room for all to see.
"Oh, that's the shot. It looks like a Sir Joshua Reynolds come to life. Isn't this the most perfect tableau you've ever seen?"
Oliver said to Patrick.
"If only Nigel could join them in the photo and take his shirt off, then it would be perfect," Patrick whispered back.
"I'm speechless. It's so gorgeous, I can hardly believe it. Nigel, this is going to be our best cover ever,"
gushed Violet Poon, the editor-in-chief of Singapore Tattle.
"Oliver, I'll admit I thought you were out of your mind when you said you wanted to cut all her hair off. But it was a stroke of genius. Kitty looks so soignée, like Emma Stone. She's positively regal now. I can already see the headline on the cover. Princess Kitty. I'm going to take a picture of this glorious print for my friend Yolanda, since she so kindly allowed us to borrow her Irish setters for the shoot."
Violet snapped a picture on her phone and immediately sent it out in a text. Minutes later, she excitedly reported,
"Yolanda is absolutely crazy about the photo."
"Would this be Yolanda Armanjiwo you're referring to?"
Oliver asked.
"The one and only. This is the woman who's so pretentious she put a Picasso in her powder room right above the toilet so everyone has no choice but to notice it while they pee. She's really not like that, Oliver. Haven't the two of you met?"
"I'm not sure she'd ever deign to meet me, since I don't have a title or my own plane."
"Oh, come on, Oliver. You know Yolanda would love to meet you. She's throwing one of her famous dinners tonight. I'll see if you can come,"
Violet said as she continued to text at warp speed. A few moments later, she looked up at Oliver.
"Guess what? Yolanda wants to invite everyone to her dinner. You, Nigel, and especially Kitty."
"No doubt she's heard about Kitty's three planes," Oliver quipped.
"Oliver Sin, don't be like that," Violet scolded.
Oliver approached Kitty, who was now posing languidly, Madame Recamier style, in a vintage emerald green and white striped Anuska Hempel ball gown, as Nigel and his team rearranged the lighting for a more dramatic evening look.
"Do you think this pose works?"
Kitty asked.
"It's gorgeous. So guess what they're going to put on the cover of Tattle as a headline to your photo? Princess Kitty."
Kitty's eyes widened.
"Oh my God, I love it."
"And guess who has just invited you to dinner tonight? Yolanda Armanjiwo."
Kitty couldn't believe her ears.
"This is that lady Tattle calls the Empress of Entertaining?"
"The very one,"
Violet said excitedly.
"I sent her a pic from your photo shoot, and she's absolutely bonkers to meet you. See, your photo shoot isn't even out yet, and already you're the toast of the town. Princess Kitty, please say you'll come tonight."
"Of course. I'll change my plans,"
Kitty said. She had planned a moonlight dinner cruise alone with Nigel, but this, she felt, was more important.
"Splendid! 8 o'clock sharp. White tie."
"White tie? In Singapore?"
Oliver frowned.
"Oh, yes. You'll see. Yolanda does things on a grand scale. She entertains like no one else I know."
Several hours later, Oliver, Nigel, and Kitty found themselves in Yolanda Armanjiwo's drawing room, a vast space with black travertine floors that felt more like the lobby of a resort hotel than a home. Half the room was comprised of a reflecting pool that extended outdoors into an even larger pool, and from the middle of the pool rose an immense Jeff Koons gold balloon dog. Yolanda and her husband Joey stood at the far end of the room in front of a wide marble block that displayed a collection of ancient Apulian vases. As Kitty was led to the receiving line, she knew she had made the right choice by wearing a black off-the-shoulder vintage Givenchy gown with white satin gloves and her not-overly-flashy necklace of graduated diamonds ending in a teardrop canary diamond of 40 carats. As she approached her host, flanked by her debonair escorts in their white-tie tuxedos, a butler announced in a high nasal tone,
"The Honorable Oliver Sen, Mr. Nigel Barker, and Mrs. Jack Bing."
Yolanda was a tall, thin woman with a gravity-defying bouffant hairdo, clad in a dramatic strapless scarlet column gown that Kitty recognized to be Christian Dior couture. She had obviously chosen her plastic surgeon with meticulous care, since she possessed one of those faces that looked perfectly taut and sculpted, but not a single muscle moved when she spoke, which was a pity, since she spoke in an exceedingly warm, rapid-fire Indonesian accent.
"Oliver Sen, we meet at last. I am such an admirer of your family, and of course your grandfather was such a great man, so revered, Nigel Barker. How lovely to meet you. My God, what a beautiful set of pictures you took today. Can I commission you to please do a portrait of my Irish setters?"
"Actually, I did take some pictures of just the two of them. I'm having them printed as a gift to you."
"Oh my goodness, Joey, did you hear that? Nigel Barker did a portrait of Liam and Neil, and we didn't even have to pay him $1 million.
Yolanda prodded her husband frantically, who looked like he was in the midst of waking from a long coma. Was all the short, punchy man said, his eyelids heavy.
"And you must be the divine Kitty Bing. I have heard so much about you. And my God, what a divine dress. It must be a classic Givenchy. And that party you threw during Shanghai Fashion Week. Ooh la la. I wish I had been there. Karl Lagerfeld told me your new villa is to die for. And your plane, the big one, has a spa in it. My God, what a genius idea. I must visit. I absolutely must."
"Thank you. Of course you'll have to visit my spa. We call it the Mile High Spa."
"Ha ha, he he, Mile High Spa. You're too funny. Oh my goodness, Kitty, I know we are going to be dear, dear friends."
As the Amangiwos continued to greet the arriving guests, Kitty broke into a big smile as she spotted Wandi Megaharto with Jawa arriving.
"Kitty!"
Wandi screamed from across the room as the two ladies ran to hug as though they hadn't just seen each other yesterday.
"What are you doing here?" Kitty asked excitedly.
"Joey's my cousin. I always get invited to these dinners because Yolanda needs me to sit beside him to keep him awake."
"Look at you. I love the new hairstyle. You look like Emma Thompson. How did the shoot go today?"
"It was fantastic. I couldn't be happier."
"Well, I'm so happy to see you here. We're going to have such a good time."
"You know, Joanne Roca, Yvonne Tanne, is the celebrity chef tonight. He has the top restaurant in the world right now, El Cella Decan Roca.
It's so hard to get a reservation. You have to murder someone to get on the list."
"I wonder who else Yolanda invited."
"Oh, look who's here. It's the First Lady of Singapore."
Kitty looked over and saw Oliver greeting the First Lady as if they were both embarrassed to be seeing each other at the party.
"You are among the creme de la creme of Singapore now, Kitty. These parties are so exclusive that no photographers are ever allowed," Wandi said, just as a roving photographer dressed in a black tuxedo flashed his camera at them.
"That's Yolanda's personal documentarian. It's not for the public," Wandi quickly explained.
"Oh, look, here comes the footman.
This means we are adjourning to the dining room."
A set of grand double doors were opened, and as Kitty walked through the arched doors, her eyes widened in wonder. She felt as if she had been transported back to a royal banquet in 18th century France. The room was a mirrored chamber decorated with Baroque gold boiseries, gilt bronze mirrors stretching from floor to ceiling, and dozens of candle-lit crystal chandeliers. An immense dining table that seated 30 stretched along the middle of the room, heaving with Meissen china, gilt silverware, and towering gold birdcage centerpieces filled with white doves. The room sparkled under the light of thousands of candles, and footmen with powdered white wigs and dressed in black and gold livery stood behind every Armian tapestry-covered chair.
Hashtag Madame fucking Pompadour, Oliver muttered under his breath.
Yolanda had this dining room rescued from an old crumbling palace in Hungary and transported here piece by piece. It took 3 years to restore it to its former glory,
Wandi proudly announced.
Can we do this at my house? Find an old palace and transport the dining room over?
Kitty whispered to Oliver. Oliver cast Kitty a disapproving look.
Absolutely not. Alexis de Rede would be projectile vomiting in his grave if he saw this travesty.
Kitty didn't have a clue what he meant, but she was only too thrilled to be shown to her seat by a handsome footman, where her place card was a small antique gilt mirror with her name etched in glass. As she was about to sit down, the man beside her grabbed her arm.
Madame, not yet. We don't sit until the First Lady has been seated. Yolanda follows the official court protocols here, he said in a Scandinavian accent.
Oh, sorry. I had no idea,
Kitty said. She stood by her seat, watching everyone stand at their places. Finally, the butler standing by the double doors announced,
The Honorable First Lady of the Republic of Singapore.
The First Lady entered and was shown to her seat. Kitty's 5-inch Gianvito Rossi heels were beginning to kill her, and she couldn't wait to sit down. But the First Lady perplexingly remained standing by her seat near the head of the table. Why the fuck was everyone still standing? The butler entered the room again and called out in a booming voice,
The Earl and Countess of Palliser!
Kitty's eyes widened in shock as a tall blonde man entered the room, dressed casually in a button-down shirt, khaki chinos, and a rumpled navy blazer. By his side was Colette, dressed in a long white cotton eyelet dress with her hair pulled into a casual ponytail. She didn't appear to be wearing any makeup, and her only jewelry was a pair of pearl and coral drop earrings. After reacting to the shock of seeing her nemesis in Singapore, Kitty wanted to laugh out loud at how inappropriately Colette was dressed. This stepdaughter of hers was a complete disgrace. Did Colette even know where she was? And then, to Kitty's horror, the First Lady of Singapore performed a deep curtsy. Yolanda Amanjiwo and all the other guests in the room quickly followed suit, the men bowing low and the women dropping curtsies as the Earl and Countess of Palliser were led to the place of honor. Chapter 12 Botanic Gardens, Singapore. It was still dark when Colin and Nick entered the grounds of the Botanic Gardens. Declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 2015, the Singapore Botanic Gardens is cherished by locals in the same way Central Park is by New Yorkers or Hyde Park is by Londoners. A verdant oasis in the middle of the island, filled with amazing botanical specimens, colonial-era pavilions, and one of the most amazing orchid collections on the planet. It's no wonder that so many Singaporeans want to have a tiny bit of their ashes scattered here. In secret, of course, since it's highly illegal. No one escapes the law in Singapore, not even the dead. They followed to a T the instructions in the mysterious letter that Nick had received, parking in the Glen Eagles Hospital parking lot, and crossing Clooney Road to enter the gardens through a little-known side gate. Just as the letter had said, the gate had been left unlocked. As they walked down the tree-lined pathway, monkeys could be heard chattering and leaping through the bushes, no doubt alarmed by the sudden presence of humans in this secluded part of the garden. God, it's been years since I've been here, Nick commented. Why would you come here? You had your own private botanic gardens right next door, Colin said. Sometimes, my dad and I would go on walks here, just for a change, and I only wanted to go to the lake with the two islands in the middle. I called it my secret island, Wait a minute. Let's check the instructions again, Nick said, unfolding the map that had been placed inside the envelope. Colin held his iPhone up to provide some lighting, while Nick peered at the map intently. Okay, the animal topiaries are over on the right, so I think we're supposed to cut through this grove of trees right here.
There isn't any path, Colin said.
I know, but the arrow points down this way. Lit only by the light of their phones, they ventured into the thick of the forest, Colin feeling a little creeped out.
It's pitch black in here. Why do I feel like I'm suddenly in the Blair Witch Project?
Maybe we'll run into a Pontianak, Nick joked.
If you read China Rich Girlfriend, you'd already know what a Pontianak is. But just in case you haven't, and why the hell haven't you? Allow Dr. Sandy Tan, the world's foremost Pontianakologist, to elucidate you. A tropical female vampire slash dryad combo, often assuming the form of a comely, sarong-draped maiden who inhabits the darker corners of the Southeast Asian jungle. Her metamorphosis into her true form will reveal putrefying gray flesh, mucho teeth, many claws, accompanying unpleasant odors. Her traditional prey is the unborn fetus of a pregnant woman consumed in situ. Though, during severe hunger pangs, any living person, even flatulent, stringy grandpas, would suffice. She can be summoned by tying a white string between two adjacent banana trees and intoning a chant of your own choosing. But she's more than capable of being an independent operator. Must not be confused with her inelegant country cousins, also female bloodsuckers, the Pananggalan, bodiless flying she-demon with long, unwashed hair and a meaty chandelier of entrails, and the Palisit, an all-purpose slave, horrendously and pathetically devoted to a conjurer with no agency of her own.
Don't joke. A lot of people say that parts of the botanic gardens are haunted, you know. I mean, the Japanese tortured and killed people all over the island.
Good thing we're not Japanese, Nick said.
Soon, the trees gave way to a trail, and after following it for a few minutes, they came upon a small concrete hut under an enormous casuarina tree.
I think this is it. It's some sort of pump room, Nick said, trying to peer in through the darkened windows.
Suddenly, a dark figure darted out from behind the tree.
Pontianak!
Colin yelled, dropping his iPhone in panic.
Sorry, it's just me,
a female voice said. Nick flashed his iPhone in the direction of the figure, and suddenly before them, illuminated in the white-blue light, appeared Astrid in an audaciously large vetmon hoodie with super-long sleeves and tight camouflage pants.
Jesus, Astrid! I almost shit myself, Colin exclaimed.
Sorry, I was scared for a moment when you first walked up, and then I realized it was you guys, Astrid said.
Nick smiled in relief.
I'm assuming you got the same note I did about seeing Amma.
Yes. It was all rather mysterious. I was at my parents' watching Cassian swim in the pool. I must have dozed off in my deck chair for a moment, because when I got up, there was a tray of iced tea and pandan cake by my side, and the envelope was under the cake. Cassian swears he didn't see who put it there.
How curious. Are you okay? Nick asked.
I'm fine. It didn't really spook me.
Just as Astrid said this, a light came on inside the pump room, and the three of them jumped a little in shock. The steel door could be heard being unlocked from the inside, and as it opened with a loud rusty creak, a turban silhouette could be seen peeking out.
Vikram!
Nick said excitedly.
Come, quickly!
Vikram instructed, ushering them all in.
What is this place?
Astrid asked.
This is the pump room that controls the intake for the two ponds, Vikram said as he led them toward the back of the space, which was crammed with machinery.
Behind a large round pipe going into the ground, a barely discernible panel opened to reveal a dark, gaping void.
This is where we're going. Each of you take turns. There are ladder rungs against the inner wall of this pipe,
Is this what I think it is? Nick said in astonishment. Vikram smiled. Come on, Nikki, you go first. Nick hauled himself into the small crawl space and climbed down what seemed like a dozen or so rungs. After landing on solid ground, he helped Astrid find her footing as she descended the steps. When the four of them finally made it down, they found themselves in a small, steel-walled vestibule. An old sign nailed against one wall read in English, Chinese, and Malay. Danger! No outlet. Chamber will flood during valve release. Vikram pushed against one of the wall panels, and it opened to reveal a well-lit tunnel. Nick, Astrid, and Colin entered with mouths agape, stunned by the existence of such a space.
No fucking way!
Colin exclaimed. This tunnel leads to Tyrsel Park, doesn't it? Nick asked excitedly. It goes right under Adam Road and puts us within the grounds of the house. Let's go. We don't have much time, Vikram said. As they made their way through the tunnel, Nick looked around in wonderment. There were spots of mold along some of the concrete walls, and the ground was caked in a layer of dirt, but overall, the tunnel was remarkably well preserved. When I was a little kid, my father used to tell me stories about how there were secret passages in Tyrsel Park, and I just thought he was pulling my leg. I begged him to show me one, but he never would.
Did you always know this was here? Astrid asked.
Not until yesterday, Vikram said. Arling told me about it. Apparently, this tunnel was used during the war by your great-grandfather Sheng Lu Ma. That's how he got in and out of the property, and was never once caught by the Japanese.
I've heard there are tunnels similar to this. There's supposedly one that leads from Uncle Kuan Yu's house on Oxley Road to the Astana, Astrid commented. I just never imagined Tyrsel Park would have one, too.
Incredible! I can't believe this whole elaborate plan just to see your grandmother, Colin remarked to Nick.
Yes, apologies for all the cloak and dagger. Arling and I needed to devise a way to get messages to the both of you without incriminating ourselves. Tyrsel Park has been on complete lockdown for the past few days, as you are well aware, Vikram said with a grin.
I'm so grateful, Vikram, Nick smiled back at him. They arrived at the end of the tunnel and faced another set of rungs. Nick went first, and when he was out of the shaft, he looked down at Astrid as she climbed up.
You'll never believe where we are.
Astrid climbed out of the shaft and found herself standing in the middle of hanging orchid plants. They were in their grandmother's orchid conservatory, and the large round stone table carved with griffins at its base in the middle of the conservatory rolled to the side to reveal the entrance into the tunnel.
I've spent countless hours sitting at this table having afternoon tea with Armand, Astrid exclaimed.
Standing on the lookout at the door of the conservatory was Arling.
Come, come, let's get in before it gets light and people start waking up.
When they were all safely ensconced inside Arling's room in the servants' quarters, she wasted no time in explaining her plan.
Colin, you should stay here in my room, out of sight. I will take Astrid and Nikki up to Suyi's bedroom. I know a special route that will let us enter from the balcony outside her dressing room. And Astrid, you should go in alone first and be with her when she awakes. She will usually wake up after you draw the curtains open. She'll be pleased to see you. And then you can tell her that Nikki is outside waiting to see her. This way, she won't get a shock if she wakes up and sees Nikki standing right there.
Good thinking, Nick said.
Madri and Patravadi know about the plan. They are stationed right outside her door in the sitting room. Usually the nurses will check on her every 15 minutes, but today they will block the nurses from entering. Professor Un usually does his first check-in at 7:30. Now, Astrid, I'm counting on you to be outside Sui's bedroom at 7:30 to intercept him. I've seen how he defers to you.
Astrid nodded.
Don't worry. I'll deal with Professor Un.
The other thing is Eddie.
These days, he likes to be the first to visit Sui in the morning. But I got Aching to make his favorite crepes with Lal's golden syrup this morning. So I will tell him he needs to eat them while they're hot. I'll try to keep him at breakfast as long as possible.
Maybe you can slip a sedative into his crepe batter, Nick suggested. Or something to give him explosive diarrhea, Colin said. They all laughed for a moment, and then Arling got up from her chair.
Okay, everyone ready?
Nick and Astrid proceeded up the servant's staircase to the second floor, following quietly behind Arling as she expertly guided them through the service hallways until they found themselves on the balcony outside Sui's dressing room. Astrid opened the door as quietly as she could and tiptoed in. The cool, mosaic tile space adjoining Sui's bedroom smelled of jasmine and lavender water. She stood by the doorway, peeked into her grandmother's bedroom, and saw Sui's ladies' maids silently prepping the room for the morning. Madri was spritzing a beautiful pot of orchids with water, while Patravadi was tidying up the nurse's station. The minute they saw Astrid, they nodded at her and pulled the curtains open. Then the two ladies slipped out of the bedroom, closed the door behind them, and stood guard diligently outside. A nurse could be heard behind the door asking,
"Is Mrs. Young awake yet? Are you getting her breakfast?"
One of the ladies' maids replied,
"She wants to sleep a little longer today. We will send for her breakfast after 8.
Astrid headed first to the side table, opened a bottle of Adele Bowden water, and refilled one of the cups. Then she took it over to Sui's bedside and sat down in the chair beside her. Sui's eyelids fluttered open, her eyes hazily registering Astrid beside her.
"Good morning, Amma,"
Astrid said cheerily.
"Here, drink some water."
Sui accepted the water gratefully, and after satiating her parched throat, she looked around the room and asked,
"What day is today?"
"It's Thursday."
"Did you just return from India?"
"Yes, Amma,"
Astrid fibbed, not wanting to cause her grandmother any undue concern.
"Let me see your ring," Sui said.
Astrid held her hand up to show her grandmother her engagement ring. Sui studied it carefully.
"I knew it would look perfect on you."
"I don't know how to thank you for this, Amma."
"Did everything go according to plan? Did Charlie manage to surprise you?"
"Yes. I was so stunned."
"Were there elephants? I told Charlie he needed to arrive on an elephant. That's how my friend, the Maharaja of Bikaner, proposed to his queen."
"Yes, there was an elephant,"
Astrid laughed, realizing just how involved her grandmother had been in helping to plan the whole affair.
"Are there any pictures?"
"No, we didn't take any. Oh, wait a minute."
Astrid took out her phone and did a quick Google search for the paparazzi photos that had been leaked of her private moment. She never imagined how useful they would be until this moment. As she showed a few of the snapshots to her eager grandmother, she thought how ironic it was that the rest of her family was so upset by what was one of the happiest moments in her life. Sui sighed.
"It looks beautiful. I wish I could have been there. Charlie looks so handsome in his outfit. Tell me, is he in Singapore now?"
"Actually, he'll be coming to town tomorrow. He comes to visit his mother every month."
"He's a good boy, that one. I knew from the moment I met him that he will always take good care of you."
Sui stared at the grainy shot of Charlie putting the ring on Astrid's finger.
"You know, of all the jewelry I own, this ring is the most special to me."
"I know, Amma."
I never got the chance to ask your grandfather if he bought it.
What do you mean? Who would have bought this engagement ring if not him?
Your grandfather did not have that much money when I first met him. He was just a recent medical graduate. How on earth would he have been able to afford this canary diamond?
You're right. It would have cost a fortune at the time, Astrid said.
I always suspected that Uncle Sien Sai Te was the one who bought it, since he helped to broker the marriage. The quality of the stone isn't perfect, but when I wore it, it always reminded me of how life can surprise you. Sometimes, the thing that at first appears flawed can end up being the most perfect thing in the world for you. Sui was silent for a few moments, and then she looked at her granddaughter with a sudden intensity.
Astrid,
I want you to promise me something.
Yes, Amma.
If I die before your wedding day, please don't go into all that mourning nonsense for me. I want you to have your wedding just as you planned in March. Will you promise me you'll do that?
Oh, Amma, nothing's going to happen. You're going to be sitting in the front row of my wedding.
Astrid stammered. I'm planning on it, but I wanted to say this just in case.
Astrid looked away, trying to hold back her tears. She sat there, holding her grandmother's hand for a few quiet moments before she said,
Amma, you know who's back in Singapore to see you?
Nikki.
Nikki's home?
Yes.
He's here. In fact, he's right outside. Do you want to see him now?
Send him in. I thought he was going to be here last week.
Astrid got up from her chair and was about to head for the dressing room when her grandmother said,
Wait a minute.
Astrid stopped in her tracks and turned around.
Yes?
Is his wife here as well?
Sui asked.
No, it's just him.
Astrid paused for a second, anticipating another question from her grandmother. But Sui was now fidgeting with the bed controls, raising the incline of her bed to the exact angle she wanted. Astrid proceeded to the balcony, where she found Nick sitting pensively at the wrought iron table.
Is she awake?
He asked.
Yes.
How is she?
She's okay. A lot better than I was expecting, actually. Come on. Your turn.
She really wants to see me?
Nick asked trepidatiously. Astrid smiled at her cousin. For a moment, he looked like he was 6 years old again.
Don't be ridiculous. Of course.
She's ready for you now.
Chapter 13. Changi Airport, Singapore. Oliver had just boarded his flight to London and was in the process of stealing an extra pillow from the seat behind him when Kitty called.
Morning, Kitty,
he said cheerily, steeling himself for the barrage he knew was about to come.
Did you sleep well?
Are you fucking kidding me? That was the worst night of my entire life.
I knew several billion people who would have happily traded places with you, Kitty. You got to attend one of Yolanda Amanjiwo's legendary dinners. The world's most acclaimed chef prepared a 12-course tasting menu for you. Did you not enjoy that? I thought the langoustines were superb.
Ugh. That so-called genius chef from that De La Sella place should be locked in his own cellar, and they should throw away the key.
Come on, aren't you being a bit harsh?
Just because you don't appreciate deconstructed, surrealist Catalan fusion cuisine doesn't mean you should sentence him to the gallows. I could have eaten 10 more plates of that jamón ibérico flash-frozen fried rice.
How could I possibly appreciate the food when I was being tortured? I've never been more humiliated in my life. Kitty seethed.
I don't know what you mean, Kitty, Oliver said lightly, as he took the stack of in-flight magazines out of the seat pocket and shoved them into the pocket adjacent to him before the passenger arrived. Anything for the extra legroom.
Everybody at the dinner curtsied to Colette. That snotty Swedish ambassador guy next to me glared at me when I didn't move. But I'll be damned if I curtsy to my own stepdaughter.
Well, Thorsten obviously did not know who you were, and Kitty, that whole curtsying thing was a complete farce. I don't know which edition of Debrett's Yolando Amanjiwo is reading, but she was absolutely incorrect. A British earl does not have precedence over the First Lady of the country where he is nothing more than a visitor. They should have been bowing to her. But these Singaporeans are so awed by any Ang Mo with a two-bit title that they just bow and scrape away like subservient little toadies. I remember a time when the Countess of Mountbatten came to visit Tyersal Park, and Sui wouldn't even come downstairs to receive her.
You're missing the point. Everyone treated Colette like royalty all through the dinner. They were dressed like peasants, and the people were still sucking up. That idiot on my right wouldn't even lift his fork until Colette lifted her fork. And then the minute she was done with her dinner, we all had to stop. That Carolina Herrera perfumed flan was the first thing I was actually enjoying. But then dinner abruptly ended, and the royal couple was off.
The last thing I thought I ever wanted to eat was a dessert that tasted like Carolina Herrera, but that was superb, wasn't it? Well, aren't you at least glad the dinner passed with no incident? Colette didn't try to insult you or cause a scene.
No. What she did was worse. She didn't even acknowledge my presence, and I'm married to her father, the man who pays all her bills even though she won't talk to him anymore. Do you know how hurt he feels? That ungrateful, spoilt little beast.
Kitty, I wouldn't take it so personally if I were you. There were 30 of us in that ghastly room, 60 if you count the ridiculous footmen, and Yolanda was dominating every minute of Lucien and Colette's time. Trust me, I was right opposite from them. You were on the other end of the table, hidden behind those ridiculous birdcage centerpieces. I honestly don't think she even saw you.
Colette saw me, I can assure you. She doesn't miss a thing. Why was she even in Singapore anyway?
Lucien is an environmentalist, and they're going to be based in Singapore for the next month, that's all. They're on their way to Sumatra to observe the orangutan situation.
What orangutan situation?
Oh, it's quite a tragedy. Thousands of orangutans are dying because of deforestation in their natural habitats. Colette's become quite involved in orangutan orphan rescue.
That's what you talked about? There was no mention of me?
Of her father?
Kitty, I can assure you that the only people that were mentioned by name happened to be orangutans.
So she doesn't know you and I have a connection?
She doesn't. But what would it matter anyway? Why didn't you just come over and say hi? Be the bigger person and welcome her to Singapore. That would have been the smart move, Oliver said as he struggled to tuck his leather valise under the seat next to him.
Huh. I am her stepmother. She should introduce herself to me, not the other way around.
Wait a minute. Are you saying you've never met Colette? Oliver was genuinely shocked.
Of course not. I told you, she hasn't seen her father since she found out about our affair, and she wouldn't come to the wedding. She hasn't set foot in China in more than 2 years. She told him that he was marrying a whore.
Oliver could hear the tears in her voice, and he began to see the situation in a whole new light. No wonder Kitty had been traumatized when Colette made her grand entrance last night. In China, Kitty had been eclipsed by Colette in absentia. And here in Singapore, she had been eclipsed again in an even more dramatic fashion. A flight attendant gestured to Oliver. Kitty, my flight to London is about to take off now, so I have to put away my phone.
Oh, really?
I thought no one cared if you used your phone in first class.
Well, you don't know this, but I'm one of those aviation geeks that actually likes to watch the safety demonstration.
I didn't know you were off to London again. You should have told me. I would have lent you one of my planes.
That's very kind of you. Kitty, I'm going to spend the next 14 hours on this flight coming up with a plan. I promise you, Colette will never humiliate you again.
You promise?
Absolutely. And look on the brighter side. You have so much to look forward to. Your Tattle cover is coming out next month. You will be an absolute sensation, I tell you. And you're besties with Yolanda Amanjiwo now. This is just the beginning for you, Kitty. Colette has to head back to some drafty old manor in England while we are designing you the most spectacular house Singapore has ever seen. Kitty sighed. Oliver was right. There was so much to look forward to. She put down her phone and looked in the small gilt mirror that was given to her as a party favor last night. She did look a bit like Emma Watson, that actress who played Hermione Granger. And Oliver, with his big round spectacles, looked a bit like Harry Potter. Oliver really was a kind of wizard. And now he was going to wave his wand and bring even more magic into her life. On the SQ-909 flight to London, Oliver turned off his phone and tucked it into the seat pocket. A flight attendant suddenly leaned into his row.
"Excuse me? Is that an extra pillow I see? I'm afraid I'm going to need that," she said with an apologetic smile.
"I'm sorry. I didn't even see it," Oliver lied.
"And is that your leather bag? I'm also going to have to ask you to tuck it under your own seat. Make sure the straps are tucked in completely. We have a very full cabin here in economy class today," the stewardess said.
"Oh, of course," Oliver said, as he bent down to retrieve his bag, cursing silently. It was going to be a very long flight. Chapter 14. Tyersal Park, Singapore. The morning light filtering through the windows made the mahogany Art Deco furniture in Sui's bedroom glow like amber, and Nick was shocked for a moment to see how tiny and frail his grandmother looked in the middle of her hospital bed. The machines clustered around her like an army of invading robots. It had been almost 5 years since he had seen her, and now a tremendous sense of remorse descended over him. How had he let so much time pass? He had lost 5 precious years because of a quarrel, because of his pride. As Nick approached her bed, he was temporarily at a loss for words. Astrid stood by Nick's side for a moment, and then she announced in a gentle voice,
"Amma, here's Nicky."
Sui opened her eyes and gazed up at her grandson.
"Tiana, he looks more and more like his grandfather every day," she thought to herself. "You look even handsomer than before. I'm glad you haven't put on any weight. Most men put on weight after they get married. Look how bloated Eddie has become."
Nick and Astrid both laughed a little, breaking the tension in the room.
"I'll be back in a while,"
Astrid said, quietly slipping out through the bedroom door. No sooner had she closed the door behind her than Professor Un entered Sui's sitting room.
"Good morning, Professor Un,"
Astrid said cheerily, blocking his way. The doctor was momentarily taken aback. It had been more than a week since he had seen Astrid, and he couldn't believe how she was dressed today. Holy Annabelle Chong! She looked even sexier than he could have possibly imagined, in the skater punk outfit and those bootylicious camouflage pants. It was better than any Japanese schoolgirl porn site. Was she wearing a sports bra under that big hoodie? Her body was a work of God. Recovering himself, Professor Woon put on his blasé clinical tone. "Ah, Astrid, welcome back. I was just about to run the morning vitals on your grandmother."
"Oh, don't you think that can wait for a moment? Why don't you give me an update first, since I've been away? Amma seems rather well this morning.
Could her condition be improving? Professor Un frowned. It's possible. We put her on a new cocktail of beta blockers, and she's benefited from a sustained period of rest.